Griffin, Chimera, or Riddling Sphinx, boo! A Life by Lindy West. My friends and I signed up for all of Ms. Harper's classes religiously, though, so autobiography it was. Ms. Harper was one of those young, cool teachers who understood jokes and wore normal clothes, and you could tell she still had a social life and probably went to bar trivia and maybe even a Tori Amos concert once in a while for a fun gals' night. We were mildly infatuated with her, because she was a relatable human being in the alienating, chaotic landscape of public high school. Unlike, say, the primordial Spanish teacher who seemed to be carved out of desk, whose favorite lesson plan was to turn on Lambada, the Forbidden Dance, and doze off. Footnote. Once we got bored of Lambada, a few months into the school year, he'd switch to a Spanish dub of the 1996 Michael Keaton human cloning comedy Multiplicity, or Mis Otros Yo. Ms. Harper was the kind of baby showers and brunch friend I imagined myself having mimosas with when I was, like, 32. Coincidentally, I ran into Ms. Harper at a movie theater when I was 32, moved to giddily embrace her, and she did not remember me. Fine. It's fine. For the final exam, we were supposed to make a presentation, 10 or 15 minutes long, about anything we wanted. Any hobby or interest that we felt made us unique. Whatever our thing was. One guy showed us his scuba gear and talked about why he liked scuba diving. I don't remember, but fish, probably? A quiet, unassuming dude brought in a massive easel on which he displayed his painstakingly detailed step-by-step guide to getting dipped, which was a kind of proto-Tom Haverford swagger manual. Step one, get money. The band kids showed off their spit valves, and the outdoor ed kids bragged about their search and rescue pagers, and someone served pupusas that she made with her mom. As the date of my presentation loomed, so did my despair. Anything that could remotely be considered my thing was either too childish, too insignificant, or too dorky to say out loud in front of a room full of teenagers. What? Collecting miniature ceramic cat families? Choir? Feminist young adult high fantasy? I might as well do my presentation on my binky, or calling the cops on Jeremy's house party, or whatever style of jeans is most unfashionable during your era deep in the future in which scholars and kings are no doubt still reading this classic book. How are you supposed to choose what represents you as a human being when you have no idea who you are yet? When I asked myself the question honestly, what is my thing? The only answer I could come up with was that I liked watching TV, eating hot sandwiches, and hanging out with my friends. Tragically, I was not enough of a visionary at the time to turn Leah, Hester, Emily, Aditi, Tyler, Claire, and a panini into an oral report, so I was like, shrug, I guess I'll go with watching TV. I really did. I stayed up all night the night before my presentation, two VCRs whirring hot on the floor of our basement, editing together a montage of all my top clips. I arranged them chronologically, not by release date, but in the order in which I'd loved them, from my favorite when I was a toddler, John Cleese guesting on The Muppet Show, all the way up to what my friends and I were having giggle fits over at the time, Mr. Show. Even though this was pre-YouTube, pre-torrenting, pre-home editing software, I had everything I needed on hand. Since sixth grade, I'd been obsessively recording off the TV and had amassed a mountain of painstakingly labeled VHS tapes. I taped Letterman and Conan every night. I taped Talk Soup, SNL, Politically Incorrect, every stand-up special on Comedy Central, Fawlty Towers, Garfield's Halloween Adventure, the earliest episodes of The Daily Show. Anything I thought was funny, I taped it, and watched it over and over, hoping to absorb its powers. I don't remember everything that ended up in my montage, but I know I used the part in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, favorite movie, 1989 to present, when Bill's trying to keep his stepmom from noticing that he and Keanu Reeves are forcing six kidnapped historical figures to do his chores. These are my friends. Herman the Kid, Socrates Johnson, Bob Genghis Khan. There was this Conan clip I thought was so fucking funny, a character called the Narcoleptic Craftsman, where the entire bit was that the Narcoleptic Craftsman would fall asleep during a woodworking segment and cut all his fingers off. See, Andy Richter deadpanned, have a craftsman on, or have a narcoleptic on. It's when you combine the two that you get something like this. I cut all my treasures together on one tape, wrote up some hasty trash about how my favorite pastime is laughing. Footnote, fire hose of vomit. Claimed that this was a highly academic audit of the evolution of my sense of humor, and sped to class. As I floundered through my speech and the tape rolled, I could see disappointment solidifying on Ms. Harper's face. She liked me. She said I was smart and a good writer, and this was such an obvious cop-out. My tape was too long, and the bell rang before it was over. People wandered out without finishing it, bored. For years afterwards, thinking of that presentation made me a little sick. The following year, just months before graduation, I met a girl named Megan in Shakespeare class. We ran in overlapping circles, but somehow had never connected. From afar, I found her intimidating, and she never noticed me at all. I had that effect on people. In close quarters, though, assigned to the same group project, we were platonically, electrically smitten. Both of us, I think, relieved to finally meet someone else who was a bit much for people in all the same ways. Too loud, too awkward, too boisterous, too intense. Megan is aggressively exuberant. She doesn't say anything that isn't funny, which sounds like an exaggeration, but isn't. She was bold in ways that I had never imagined, even though I'd shrugged off most of my shyness years before. Megan was honest. She wasn't nice to people she didn't like. She talked back to authority figures if she thought they were feeding her bullshit. She delivered hard no's and didn't waver. I discovered that Megan was an obsessive comedy archivist, just like me. It was uncanny. Her bedroom was stacked with fat loaves of VHS tapes, also painstakingly labeled, in her handwriting, weirdly like mine, that she'd been recording off the TV for years, just like me. We'd drive around for hours in my Volvo, listening to Mitch Hedberg and David Cross. With the advent of Napster, we could make each other entire mixed CDs that were just audio clips from The Simpsons. Megan spent $50 on eBay, an exorbitant amount of money at the time, to get a bootleg VHS copy of every Tenacious D episode. We wore the tape out. Within months, our vocal cadence merged until even we couldn't tell our voices apart. And sometimes we went so long without saying anything that wasn't a reference or an inside joke that we might as well have been speaking some feral bog twin language. We won funniest in the senior class poll. We were fucking unbearable. Comedy has always been a safe harbor for the a bit muches of the world. The things that made Megan and me horrible to be around, the caterwauling, the irreverence, the sometimes inappropriate honesty, the incessant riffing, aren't just welcome in comedy, they're fundamental. For me, as a kid who felt lonely, ugly, simultaneously invisible and too visible, comedy felt like a friend. That's its greatest magic. More than any other art form, it forces you to interact with it. It forces you to feel not alone. Because you can't be alone when someone's making you laugh, physically reaching into your body and eliciting a response. Comedy is also smart. It speaks the truth. It was everything I wanted to be. Plus, if you're funny, it doesn't matter what you look like. During college in Los Angeles, I went to comedy shows as often as I could, usually alone. My roommates didn't much care. Patton Oswalt working out new material at M-Bar, Paul F. Tompkins singing Danny Boy at Largo, Mitch Hedberg at the Improv soon before he died. It was rapturous. We were between comedy booms at the time, and I didn't understand that normal people weren't starstruck by Marc Maron and Greg Proops and Maria Bamford. Why were they so accessible? Don't they keep the celebrities in a bunker somewhere? Why was Bob Odenkirk, the most important man in the world, sitting next to me at the bar where anyone could talk to him? How was it possible that I just accidentally body-slammed Bobcat Goldthwait outside the bathroom? Also, was he okay? He is very small. Once, at the Paul F. Tompkins show, which I never missed, I was seated at a cocktail table next to Andy Richter and his wife, Sarah Thayer. Have a craftsman on, I thought. Or have a narcoleptic on. Have a craftsman on or have a narcoleptic on. I ran to the bathroom and called Megan. Fuck you, she said. I wanted to be immersed in comedy, the creation of it and the consumption of it, all the time. I couldn't sleep without Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant's XFM radio show playing. I've probably fallen asleep to Gervais's voice more than my own mother's. I never wanted to do stand-up particularly, though I certainly nursed an idealized notion of how fun it would be to hang out in comedy club green rooms. Ha 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 ha, me now. My real Xanadu was the TV writer's room. I couldn't believe that people got paid to sit around a table and riff with their friends, building from scratch the kind of rich, brilliant TV universes that had felt like family to me growing up. I graduated in 2004 with an English degree, and a case of imposter syndrome so intense that I convinced myself I didn't have enough ideas to become a writer of any kind. Instead, when people asked me what I wanted to do with my life, I'd say this. Well, I only have one skill, which is that I know how to make sentences, kind of, but I don't know, I'm not like a writer. A compelling pitch, young West. With no other options or ideas or interests, I took an unpaid internship at a free parenting magazine in the Valley. It was essentially a packet of coupons and ads for backyard clowns, padded with a handful of articles written by interns, me, and a calendar highlighting what time Three Dog Night would be appearing at the Antelope Valley Fair, 4 p.m. There were three people in editorial, including me, and what seemed like hundreds in sales. Despite still being a child myself in like 9 out of 10 ways, exception, boobs, I threw myself gamely into the job. If I'm going to sit in a windowless office in Encino for 20 hours a week for $0, I might as well try to get some clips out of it. The slimy young businessman who owned the place didn't care that I was alarmingly, dangerously unqualified to dispense parenting advice, so I was assigned pieces on anything from what to do if your child is a bully to should you bank your baby's umbilical cord blood? I believe my answers were, I don't know, talk to it, and, yes, respectively. I can only hope that no families were destroyed during my tenure. To be fair, though, don't get your baby blood tips from a clown pamphlet. I finally quit the day one of the Slimers made me drive to a lumberyard in South Pasadena to pick up a cord of firewood for his motivational corporate firewalking side business. This was not in the terms of my internship. He instructed me to drop the wood off and unload it myself, alone, log by log, at this creepy, barren porn condo that apparently was Slimer Firewalking Incorporated's HQ. He touched my arm, slipped me $20, and asked, huskily, if I'd ever walked on hot coals. Yeah, no, I said, moving toward the door. Do you want to? He called after me. It'll change you. I'm good. In retrospect, I should have sued that place for all of its dirty, on-fire clown money. Instead, I gave up on L.A. and moved back home. Seattle, in 2005, had our own little comedy boom. I started hanging around open mics because Hari Kondabolu, college roommate of a friend, had moved to town and joined our social circle. Coincidentally, he lived in a house with the guy who brought the scuba gear into autobiography class, because Seattle is only 4 people big. When I looked at Hari's Friendster profile before we'd even met and discovered that he was a comic, I thought, holy shit, I'm about to have a comedy friend. People who were around at the time still talk about that scene with reverence. It did feel special, some lucky confluence of the right people, the right rooms, the right mentorship, the right crowds, the right branding. Comics did weird experimental stuff and filled seats at each other's shows. You could feel something happening. Meanwhile, the national comedy boom was percolating. Louis C.K. was becoming a household name. People were starting to realize the potential of podcasting. At those early Seattle shows, a few faces were ubiquitous. Hari, Emmett Montgomery, Dan Carroll, Derek Sheen, Andy Peters, Scott Moran, Andy Haynes, who was also in autobiography class, oh my god, and Ahamefele J. Oluo, a tall, gloomy, single dad who quickly formed a writing partnership with Hari and was folded into our social circle as well. I did stand up once in a while, too, usually at Hari's urging, but knew pretty quickly that it wasn't my thing. I hated telling the same jokes over and over, and I hated the grind, which means I never tried hard enough to actually get good. If you've never done stand-up in a brightly lit pizzeria at 6 p.m. in front of 4 people who were not informed that there would be comedy, try it, it's great. I liked performing, though, and eventually I started hosting the Seattle Outpost of the Moth, a live storytelling show. 3 hours of crowd work twice a month. I was good at it. Through some dark sorcery, I managed to parlay my parenting magazine clips into an internship in the theater department of The Stranger, which turned into freelance writing work, which turned into a staff position as a film critic, where I wrote goofy movie reviews and a column covering Seattle comedy called Chuckletown, USA, population, jokes. A representative excerpt. Wednesday, June 1st, Rob Delaney. Rob Delaney is the best person on Twitter. He loves pussy. Rendezvous, 10 p.m., $15, 21 and up. I was going to comedy shows at night, interviewing comics, watching movies and TV for a living, and writing jokes in the newspaper all day. Then one day, it struck me. I did it. I got paid to watch comedy and make people laugh. In just 7 years, I'd actually lived up to that stupid autobiography presentation. Like, Toby isn't a professional scuba diver, and Jessica C. isn't an itinerant bassoonist, and Jessica R. doesn't run a pupusa stand, although maybe she should get on that already because those things were hella good. I did hear a rumor that Gettin' Dipped Guy is a male model now, so technically he is professionally dipped. Touche. But other than that, I couldn't think of anyone else from class whose presentation actually foreshadowed the course of their life. Not that they were supposed to, of course. It was just a throwaway assignment. But for me, who'd struggled to define myself for so many years, it was an unexpected wonder to realize that my presentation wasn't an embarrassment. It was a goddamn prophecy. At the Bridgetown Comedy Festival in Portland in 2010, its third year, I found myself standing next to Aha Mayfile in the back of a club watching an old friend's set. The guy was doing a bit about sex, or maybe online dating. I don't remember the premise, but I remember that the punchline was herpes, and it was killing. It wasn't a self-deprecating joke about the comic's own herpes, it was about other people. People with herpes are gross, ha ha ha. Girls with herpes are sluts. I hope I never accidentally have sex with a gross slut with herpes. Let's all laugh at people with herpes and pretend like none of the people in the room has herpes, even though, depending on which statistics you believe, anywhere from 15% to 75% of the people in the room have herpes. Let's force all of those people to laugh along too. Ha ha ha. It's a lazy joke, but a common one, and a year earlier I might not have thought anything of it. Just then, though, a friend was going through some shit. A partner had lied about his STI status, then slipped the condom off without her consent. And a few weeks later, she erupted in sores so painful she couldn't walk or sit, move or not move. She was devastated, not just because of the violation, the deception and the pain, but because the disease is so stigmatized. She was sure she'd never be able to date again. It seemed entirely possible to her that she might be alone forever, and she thought maybe she deserved it. You know, I remember telling her, it's just a skin condition. A rash, like acne or hives or eczema. Are those shameful? I rubbed her back while she sobbed in my car. That interaction was fresh in my mind as I watched this dude, who's a funny, good person, tell his joke. And I thought about all the people in the audience who were plastering smiles over their feelings of shame, of being tainted and ruined forever in that moment. I thought about my friend who, unless you believe recreational sex is an abomination and STIs are God's dunce caps, didn't deserve this virus. Neither did anyone else in that room. So did she deserve to have her trauma be the butt of a joke? Even if you could milk a cheap laugh out of the word herpes, was it worth it to shore up the stigma that made real people's lives smaller and harder? Was the joke even that funny anyway? Stigma works like this. Comic makes people with herpes the butt of his joke. Audience laughs. People with herpes see their worst fears affirmed. They are disgusting, broken, unlovable. People without herpes see their worst instincts validated. They are clean, virtuous, better. Everyone agrees that no one wants to fuck someone with herpes. If people with herpes want to object, they have to, 1, publicize the fact that they have herpes, and 2, be accused of oversensitivity, of ruining the fun. Instead, they stay quiet and laugh along. The joke does well. So well that maybe the comedian writes another one. I cycled through that system over and over in my head. It was maddeningly efficient. What were people supposed to do? More broadly, in a nation where puritanical gas bags have a death grip on our public education system, can we really expect ironclad safe sex practices in people from whom comprehensive sex ed has been withheld? Blaming and shaming people for their own illnesses has always been the realm of moralists and hypocrites, of the anti-sex status quo. Isn't comedy supposed to be the vanguard of counterculture? Of speaking truth to power? The longer I turned it over, the more furious I became. Why do we all just laugh along with this? I moved close to Aham's ear and said, over the boisterous crowd, "You know, I could have herpes." He looked at me, clearly startled. A little thought throbbed in the back of my head, how handsome Aham was, with his broad shoulders and mole-brown eyes, towering over me at 6'5". He was an incredible comedian, insightful and fearless, always one of my favorites. And I'd recently found out he was a jazz musician, too, like my dad. He'd also been divorced multiple times, like my dad, and had two kids and a vasectomy, like my dad when he met my mom. A mutual friend had mentioned the other day that Aham was a great cook. Was this really a dude I wanted to say I might have herpes to? I shoved the thoughts aside. It's just a skin condition. "A ton of people in this audience probably have herpes," I went on. "But they have to pretend to laugh anyway. That has to be the worst feeling. Why do that to people when you could just write a different joke?" "I don't know," he said. "But you're right. I could have herpes too." Aham and I had been chatting at house parties and open mics for 5 years, but we didn't really know each other well. Years later, he told me that he'd always been a fan of my writing, but that moment shifted his perception of me forever. "I was just blown away to hear a woman talk like that," he said. "I started to realize that you weren't just funny. I'd always thought you were funny, but that you might be a really, really radically good person." We were inseparable for the rest of the weekend. We went to an arcade, played hours of Plinko, drank beer, helped Hari come up with burns in a text fight he was having with Mark Maron. Within a year, Aham and I were a couple, and he and my dad were playing gigs together. This was the life I'd dreamed of at 22, hanging out with comics, falling in love, riffing all day. But in the same moment, I felt my relationship with comedy changing. Death Wish. Comedy doesn't just reflect the world, it shapes it. Not in the way that church ladies think heavy metal hypnotizes nerds into doing school shootings, but in the way it's accepted fact that The Cosby Show changed America's perception of black families. We don't question the notion that The Daily Show had a profound effect on American politics, or that Ellen opened middle America's hearts to dancing lesbians, or that propaganda works, and satire is potent, and Shakespeare's fools spoke truth to power. So why would we pretend, out of sheer convenience, that stand-up exists in a vacuum? If we acknowledge that it doesn't, then isn't it our responsibility as artists to keep an eye on which ideas we choose to dump into the water supply? Art isn't indiscriminate shit-flinging. It's pure communication, crafted with intention and care. Every comedian on every stage is saying what he's saying on purpose. So shouldn't we be welcome to examine that purpose, contextualize it within our culture at large, and critique what we find? The short answer, I'd discover, is, nah, shut up, bitch, lol, get raped. For years, I assumed it was a given that at any comedy show I attended, I had to grin through a number of brutal jokes about my gender, about beating us, about raping us, about why we deserve it, about ranking us, about not fucking us, about reducing our already dehumanized existence to a handful of insulting stereotypes. This happened all the time, even at supposedly liberal alt shows, even at shows booked by my friends. Misogyny in comedy was banal. Take my wife, please. Here's one I heard at an open mic. Last night I brought this girl home, but she was being really loud during sex, so I told her, shh, you don't want to turn this rape into a murder. Every time I'd bite back my discomfort and grin, because I thought, that's just how we joke. It's just comedy. All my heroes tell me so. This is the price if I want to be in the club. Hey, men pay a price too, don't they? People probably make fun of Eddie Pepitone for being bald. When a comedian I loved said something that set off alarm bells for me, something racist, sexist, transphobic, or otherwise, I thought, it must be okay, because he says it's okay, and I trust him. I told myself, there must be a secret contract I don't know about where women or gay people or disabled people or black people agreed that it's cool, that this is how we joke. But in that moment at Bridgetown, it dawned on me, who made that rule? Who drew up that contract? I don't remember signing anything, and anyway, it seems less like a universal accord and more like a booby trap that powerful men set up to protect their right to squeeze cheap laughs out of life-ruining horrors. sometimes including literal torture, that they will never experience. Why should I have to sit and cheer through hours of edgy misogyny, edgy racism, edgy rape jokes, just to be included in an industry that belongs to me as much as anyone else? When I looked at the pantheon of comedy gods, Bill Hicks, Eddie Murphy, George Carlin, Lenny Bruce, Louis C.K., Jon Stewart, Richard Pryor, Chris Rock, Jerry Seinfeld, the alt-comedy demigods, Patton Oswalt, Zach Galifianakis, David Cross, Mark Maron, Dave Attell, Bill Burr, and even that little roster of 2005 Seattle comics I rattled off in the previous chapter, I couldn't escape the question, if that's who drafted our comedy constitution, why should I assume that my best interests are represented? That is a bunch of dudes. Of course there are exceptions. Maybe Joan Rivers got to propose a bylaw or two, but you can't tell me there's no gender bias in an industry where women aren't funny is widely accepted as conventional wisdom. I can name hundreds of white male comedians, but how about this? Name 20 female comics. Name 20 black comics. Name 20 gay comics. If you're a comedy nerd, you probably can. That's cool. Now ask your mom to do it. In the summer of 2012, a comedian named Daniel Tosh was on stage at the Laugh Factory in Hollywood. Tosh is a bro comedy hero, specializing in ironic bigotry. AIDS, retards, the Holocaust, all with a cherubic frat boy smile. The kind of jokes worshipped by teenagers and lazy comics who still think it's cool to fetishize offensiveness. Here's one of Tosh's signature, I'm just a bad baby wape jokes, about playing a prank on his sister. I got her so good a few weeks ago, I replaced her pepper spray with silly string. Anyway, that night she got raped, and she called me the next day going, you son of a bitch, you got me so good. As soon as I started spraying him in the face, I'm like, Daniel, this is gonna really hurt. See, it's a good one, because being raped really hurts. This particular night at the Laugh Factory, Tosh was working a bit more meta. According to an audience member who later posted her account anonymously online, he was making some very generalizing declarative statements about rape jokes always being funny. How can a rape joke not be funny? Rape is hilarious, etc. Uncomfortable, the woman heckled, actually, rape jokes are never funny. Tosh paused, then addressed the packed house. Wouldn't it be funny if that girl got raped by like 5 guys right now? Like right now? What if a bunch of guys just raped her? Horrified and frightened, the woman gathered her things and rushed out. She wrote later, having to basically flee while Tosh was enthusing about how hilarious it would be if I was gang-raped in that small, claustrophobic room was pretty viscerally terrifying and threatening all the same, even if the actual scenario was unlikely to take place. The suggestion of it is violent enough and was meant to put me in my place. After the predictable viral backlash, Tosh offered a predictably tepid non-apology, and comedians lined up to support him, Patton Oswalt, Jim Norton, Anthony Jeselnik, Doug Stanhope. Oswalt wrote, wow, Daniel Tosh had to apologize to a self-aggrandizing idiotic blogger. Hope I never have to do that again. Stanhope tweeted, hashtag, fuck that pig. They were standing up for free speech, for their art. These crazy bitches just didn't get it. It was a few months into my time at Jezebel, and I was tapped to write a response. I felt confident, like I was a good fit for the assignment. I knew I had a more comprehensive understanding of the mechanics and history of comedy than your average feminist blogger. I'd been writing straight-ahead humor since the beginning of my career. You couldn't say I didn't get jokes. I had enough cred on both sides to bridge the gap between the club and the coven to produce something constructive. The piece was called How to Make a Rape Joke. I actually agree with Daniel Tosh's sentiment in his shitty backpedaling tweet. Quote, the point I was making before I was heckled is there are awful things in the world, but you can still make jokes about them. Hashtag dead babies. End quote. I wrote, the world is full of terrible things, including rape, and it is okay to joke about them. But the best comics use their art to call bullshit on those terrible parts of life and make them better, not worse. This fetishization of not censoring yourself, of being an equal opportunity offender, is bizarre and bad for comedy. When did not censoring yourself become a good thing? We censor ourselves all the time because we are not entitled sociopathic fucks. In a way, comedy is censoring yourself. Comedy is picking the right words to say to make people laugh. A comic who doesn't censor himself is just a dude yelling. And being an equal opportunity offender, as in, it's okay because Daniel Tosh makes fun of all people. Women, men, AIDS victims, dead babies, gay guys, blah blah blah, falls apart when you remember, as so many of us are forced to all the time, that all people are not in equal positions of power. Oh, don't worry. I punch everyone in the face. People, baby ducks, a lion, this Easter Island statue, the ocean. Okay, well, that baby duck is dead now. I analyzed 4 rape jokes that I thought worked, that targeted rape culture instead of rape victims. In retrospect, I should have been harder on Louis C.K., whom I basically let off on a technicality. And then I explained, I'm not saying all of this because I hate comedy. I'm saying it because I love comedy, and I want comedy to be accessible to everyone. And right now, comedy as a whole is overtly hostile toward women. My point was that what we say affects the world we live in, that words are both a reflection of and a catalyst for the way our society operates. Comedy, in particular, is a tremendously powerful lever of social change. Tina Fey's Sarah Palin impression may have tipped the 2008 election for Obama. Plenty of my peers cite The Daily Show as their primary news source. When you talk about rape, I said, you get to decide where you aim. Are you making fun of rapists or their victims? Are you making the world better or worse? It's not about censorship. It's not about obligation. It's not about forcibly limiting anyone's speech. It's about choice. Who are you? Choose. I do get it. Tosh plays a character in his act, the charming psychopath. He can say things like, rape is hilarious because, according to his defenders, it's obviously not. Because everyone hates rape. It's not an uncommon strain in comedy. Anthony Jeselnik, Jeff Ross, Lisa Lampanelli, Cartman. The problem is, for those of us who actually work in anti-rape activism, who move through the world in vulnerable bodies, who spend time online with female avatars, the idea that everyone hates rape is anything but a given. The reason ironically brutal victim-targeting rape jokes don't work the way Tosh defenders claim they do is because in the real world, most sexual assault isn't even reported, let alone taken seriously. Feminists don't single out rape jokes because rape is worse than other crimes. We single them out because we live in a culture that actively strives to shrink the definition of sexual assault, that casts stalking behaviors as romance, blames victims for wearing the wrong clothes, walking through the wrong neighborhood, or flirting with the wrong person, bends over backwards to excuse boys-will-be-boys misogyny, makes the emotional and social costs of reporting a rape prohibitively high, pretends that false accusations are a more dire problem than actual assaults, elects officials who tell rape victims that their sexual violation was God's plan, and convicts in less than 5% of rape cases that go to trial. Comedians regularly retort that no one complains when they joke about murder or other crimes in their acts, citing that as a double standard. Well, fortunately, there is no cultural narrative casting doubt on the existence and prevalence of murder and pressuring people not to report it. Maybe we'll start treating rape like other crimes when the justice system does. No, no one thought that a spontaneous gang rape was going to take place just then on the stage of the Laugh Factory. But the threat of sexual violence never fully leaves women's peripheral vision. The point of Tosh's joke was to remind that woman that she is vulnerable. More importantly, it reinforces the idea that comedy belongs to men. Therefore, men must be correct when they tell us what comedy is. There are 2 competing narratives here. One is the women aren't funny narrative, which posits that women are leading the charge against rape jokes because we are uptight and humorless, we don't understand the mechanics of comedy, and we can't handle being the butt of a joke. Then there's the narrative that I subscribe to, which is, holy shit, women are getting fucking raped all the fucking time. Help us, please help us. Why are you all laughing? For God's sake, do something. As a woman, I sincerely wish it were the first one. How to make a rape joke wasn't perfect, but it accomplished what I'd hoped. It bridged the gap between feminists and shock comics in a definitive, reasoned way. It went viral like nothing I'd ever written before, the response overwhelmingly supportive from both sides. Many female comedy fans who'd long been told their voice wasn't welcome in this debate expressed relief. A lot of people said I'd finally shut the lid on the conversation. Even Patton Oswalt retweeted it. The reception was positive enough that I was able to shrug off the relatively small amount of snide abuse from the Tosh faithful. Shut the fuck up, Lindy West. Who? Just read Lindy West's article about Tosh on Jezebel. Two things. One, rape is hilarious. Two, I have no idea who she is. Shut the fuck up. I hope Lindy and all the people who commented on this article are raped. A few characterized my critiques of Tosh as a witch hunt, calling me a fascist who was trying to destroy his career and the career of any man who challenged the feminazi orthodoxy. Contrary to their dire warnings, Tosh's popularity soared. As of the writing of this book, he's still on the air. Overall, I was pleased. It felt like we'd made progress. A year passed. The following summer, 2013, a feminist writer named Sadie Doyle published an open letter to a young comic named Sam Morrill. She recently saw him in a show and found his jokes about raping and brutalizing women questionable. Like me the previous year, she hoped to engage him in a constructive dialogue rather than just throwing the same old talking points back and forth. 1 in 5 women reports being sexually assaulted, Doyle wrote. For women of color, that number is much higher. One study says that over 50% of young black women are sexually assaulted. One of your jokes. I'm attracted to black women. I had sex with one once. The whole time I was fucking her, she kept using the N-word. Yeah, the whole time she was yelling, no! On your Twitter, you warned people that they shouldn't attend one particular set of yours if they'd recently had a miscarriage or been raped. So, like, are you comfortable excluding that big a chunk of the population from your set? Reasonable questions, in my opinion. If you're leveraging people's trauma for laughs, the least you can do is look them in the face. Why make art if you don't have a point of view? The same week, feminist writer and comedian Molly Neffel published an impassioned essay about the contrast between Patton Oswalt's brutal dismissal of rape joke critiques and his too-soon reverence for the victims of the Boston Marathon bombing and the Aurora Theater shooting. Quote, "The suffering in Boston, as horrifying as it is largely abstract to a nation that has, for the most part, never experienced such a thing. On the other hand, in every room Oswalt performs comedy in, there will be a rape survivor. Statistically speaking, there will be many. There will be even more if he's performing at a university. If exceptional violence illuminates our human capacity for empathy, then structural violence shows the darkness of indifference." Both pieces are eminently reasonable and fair. They read beautifully even years later. The response from comedy fans, however, was horrific. Doyle and Neffel were interlopers, frauds, unfunny cunts, Nazis. Oswalt fans harangued Neffel for days until she took a break from the internet. Sam Morrill eventually replied to Doyle's letter with a lengthy blog post. The key quote, "Stand-up comedy is a performance, not a discourse. A dead end, a wall. You're not welcome." Women, it seemed, were obliged to be thick-skinned about their own rapes, while comics remained too thin-skinned to handle even mild criticism. I was done. I wrote an essay in defense of Neffel and Doyle. It was plainer than how to make a rape joke, less affectionately fraternal, less pliant. "Comedy clubs are an overtly hostile space for women," I said. "Even just presuming we can talk about comedy gets women ripped to shreds by territorial dudes desperate to defend their authority over what's funny. Jokes about rape and gendered violence are treated like an inevitability instead of a choice, like they're beyond questioning, like they're somehow equally sacred alongside women's actual humanity and physical sanctity. When women complain, however civilly, they're met with condescension, dismissal, and the tacit or often explicit message that this is not yours, you are not welcome here." To my surprise, Oswalt tweeted a link to my post, saying that this was feminist discourse he could respect, not like Molly's hit piece. It was a savvy move to use me for some feminist cred while discrediting the piece that called him out most damningly by name. I replied that if he agreed with me, he agreed with Neffel. Our views were not at odds. As we volleyed back and forth, I thought about a night at M-Bar in 2003 or 2004, when I'd shyly approached him after a show and told him that he was my favorite comic. He was kind and generous with his time. We talked about Seattle. Neither of us could remember the name of the movie theater on the Ave that wasn't the Neptune. Later, when I remembered, I emailed him. The Varsity. He thanked me, warm and sincere. Fighting about rape on the internet was not how I envisioned our next encounter. I was in a cab to JFK, heading home from a New York business trip, when my friend W. Kamau Bell called my cell. Kamau, at the time, had a weekly show on FX produced by Chris Rock, called Totally Biased, a sort of news-of-the-day talk show structured vaguely like The Daily Show, but with a social justice bent. Hari wrote for the show, so did Guy Branum. It was a rare writer's room. Straight white men were a minority. It was a rare show. "I want to talk to you about a crazy idea," Kamau said. "We want to do a debate about rape jokes on the show. You versus a comic. It looks like it'll be Jim Norton." "Oh, God," I laughed. "Do I have to?" Norton is a darling of dark comedy, a prince of the Opie and Anthony set, a scene that makes Howard Stern look like Terry Gross. "Jim's not like a lot of those guys, I promise," Kamau assured me. "He's not just like, ugh, feminists. You can actually have a conversation with him." We tried to get Colin Quinn, but honestly, I think you'll be better off with Jim. "Is this a trap?" I said. "I promise it's not a trap." I made arrangements to fly back to New York the following week. Now, the thing about Totally Biased was that it was a national television show, and the thing about me was that I was just some fucking lady. Aside from one bizarre time when the Canadian primetime news had me on to make fun of James Cameron, I think because the anchor had a vendetta, I had never in my life been on television. I didn't have, like, a reel. I wasn't trying to be an actor or a pundit. Me being asked to be on TV was exactly the same as, say, you being asked to be on TV, or your math teacher, or your dog, or your mommy. It was bizarre and terrifying, but I agreed because, hey, maybe I could make a difference. Maybe I could win, and comedy would open up just a crack more to female comics and audiences. My segment was going to be framed as either comedian versus feminist or feminism versus free speech, neither of which Kamau told me was his preference, but you had to package things a certain way on television. "Fine by me," I said, tamping down my anxiety about debating whether or not it's a good idea to glorify the victimization of women on stage within a framework that explicitly excludes women from even being capable of comedy. What does just some fucking lady know of television? Totally Biased taped in a haunted hotel in Midtown, the set a Penny Bright Technicolor diorama, while behind the scenes was this sort of moldering, dripping Soviet-grade dungeon tower. I gave it 50-50 odds that I'd be kidnapped by a masked erotic ghost on my way to the bathroom. I had a quick sit-down with Kamau and Guy to go over my general talking points. "The time is going to go faster than you think," Guy warned me. "Don't save all your best shit for the end. You won't get to say it." Producer Chuck Sklar took me aside and told me that Chris Rock was coming to my taping. "He doesn't usually come," he said, "but he kind of hates this whole rape joke thing. He thinks it's whiny. So he's curious to see how you're going to do." "First of all, solid pep talk, boss. Thanks. Second of all, what the fuck?" One flawed but instructive plank in the debate over rape jokes is the concept of punching up versus punching down. The idea is that people in positions of power should avoid making jokes at the expense of the powerless. That's why, at a company party, the CEO doesn't roast the janitor. "Isn't it funny how Steve can barely feed his family? This guy knows what I'm talking about," points to other janitor. Because that would be disgusting, and both janitors would have to work late to clean up everyone's barf. The issue isn't that it's tasteless and cruel, though it is, but that it mocks the janitors for getting the short end of an oppressive system that the CEO actively works to keep in place, a system that enables him to be a rich dick. In a 1991 interview with People magazine, Molly Ivins put it perfectly. "There are two kinds of humor. One kind that makes us chuckle about our foibles and our shared humanity, like what Garrison Keillor does. The other kind holds people up to public contempt and ridicule. That's what I do. Satire is traditionally the weapon of the powerless against the powerful. I only aim at the powerful. When satire is aimed at the powerless, it is not only cruel, it's vulgar." Punching up versus punching down isn't a mandate or a hard and fast rule or a universal taxonomy. I'm sure any contrarian worth his salt could list exceptions all day. It's simply a reminder that systems of power are always relevant. A helpful thought exercise for people who have trouble grasping why bitch is worse than asshole. It doesn't mean that white people are better than black people. It means that we live in a society that treats white people better than black people, and to pretend that we don't is an act of violence. Here's the reason I bring this up. I've always been told that punching up was a concept coined by Chris Rock. That attribution might be apocryphal. I can't find a direct quote from Rock himself. but my enduring comedy hero Stuart Lee said it with some authority in a New Statesman column about why right-wingers make terrible comedians. The African-American stand-up Chris Rock maintained that stand-up comedy should always be punching upwards. It's a heroic little struggle. You can't be a right-wing clown without some character caveat, some vulnerability, some obvious flaw. You're on the right. You've already won. You have no tragedy. You're punching down. Who could be on a stage crowing about their victory and ridiculing those less fortunate than them without any sense of irony, shame, or self-knowledge? That's not a stand-up comedian. That's just a cunt. Are rape jokes so sacred and misogyny so invisible that the dude who literally invented the model for social responsibility in comedy can't imagine a world without them? I never got an answer. Rock didn't come to the taping after all. Backstage before we got started, I met Jim for the first time. He told me he loved my How to Make a Rape Joke piece, said we agreed more than we disagreed. Duh, I joked. I'm right. We had a good rapport. I felt jumpy but righteous. When we got on stage, my heart sank quickly. In my intro, to an audience that largely had never heard of me, Kamau explained, "She's a staff writer for Jezebel, who's called out everyone from Louis C.K. to Daniel Tosh, and now she's ready to put Jim on blast." The majority of totally biased viewers would have no idea who I was, and they heard no mention of my lifelong comedy obsession, the fact that I've done comedy, that I write about comedy, that, at least at the time, I was most widely known in my career for writing humor. They had no reason to assume I had any standing to critique comedy at all. Before the debate had even started, I was framed as combative, bitchy, shrill. I wasn't there to have a constructive discussion, I was there to put Jim on blast. Call-out culture and putting people on blast are both loaded terms that the anti-social justice right loves to throw scornfully back at activists. To unfriendly ears, of which I'd soon learn there were many pairs listening, the terms connote overreaction, hysteria, stridence. Comedian versus feminist. I felt uneasy. Kamau addressed his first question to Jim. "Jim, do you think comedians should be able to say anything they want to say without any repercussions?" Silently, I thanked Kamau. Whether intentional or not, the question was framed in a way that forced Jim to concede a few points right off the bat. "Everything has repercussions, obviously. The audience laughs or they don't. They come see you again or they don't. They buy your album, or they don't. You get booked again, or you don't." He couldn't possibly deny that with a straight face. Jim nodded enthusiastically, eyes wide. "If you're trying to be funny, I think. Everybody knows the difference. Michael Richards said something in anger. Reasonable people can sense when you're trying to be funny and when you're trying to be angry. I think, like Matt and Trey said on South Park, it's either all okay or none of it's okay." He referenced a joke about Hitler that Kamau had made in an earlier segment, then added, "If we go down the road of, hey, don't make fun of this, don't make fun of that, well, then people have a very legitimate argument to go, well, don't mention Hitler in any context, because it's never humorous. So I'm just not comfortable going down that road. I just think as long as you're trying to be funny, you're okay." "Everybody knows the difference," he said. "Reasonable people can sense when you're trying to be funny. There's a nasty implication there. The entire rape joke debate can be boiled down to women saying, these are not just jokes. These bleed into the world and validate our abusers and reinforce our silence. These are rooted in misogyny, not humor. These are not funny. Therefore," Jim implied, "women are not reasonable people. Everybody knows the difference, except feminists, apparently." Kamau threw the question to me. I breathed sharply through my nose, trying to slow my heart. I wanted to establish myself as someone who wasn't there to equivocate, to bow and scrape, to cede ground to an older, more famous man who talks for a living. "I know what I'm talking about, and I mean it. Don't fuck with me." I also wanted to open with a laugh. "I think that question is dumb," I said. "Everything has repercussions. If you're talking about legal repercussions, yeah, I do not think that comedy should be censored, and we're not here to talk about censorship. And," I gestured to Jim, "I'm pretty sure we agree." The censorship argument is a boring red herring. I wanted to knock it down early. Rape joke apologists are quick to cry free speech, to use the word allowed, as though there are certain things comedians are and aren't allowed to say anymore. barring the most extreme forms of hate speech and credible specific threats of violence, there's no legislative body governing comedy club stages. The Thought Police is not a real law enforcement agency. What I'm talking about is the kind of repercussion where you choose to say something that traumatizes a person who's already been victimized, and then I choose to call you a dick. Jim cut in. I totally agree with you. Great, are we done? And if you think somebody sucks for what they said on stage, you should blog about it. You should write about it, as long as a person isn't calling for somebody to get in trouble for an opinion or a joke. The vagueness of trouble felt like a misdirection. But what do you mean by trouble? I asked, trying to pin him down. Is the trouble people are mad at you? The trouble is, I do Opie and Anthony, the radio show. So a lot of time, the trouble people will do is, if you're doing jokes they don't like, they begin to target your advertisers. Because the market should dictate whether or not people enjoy you. But they'll go to the advertisers and say, they're making jokes that we don't like, so remove your advertising support. Which is a way to punish them. That's the type of trouble I'm talking about. So Jim was fine with people complaining about comedians, as long as we do it where no one can hear us, as long as we don't complain in any of the ways that actually produce change. No petitions, no letter-writing campaigns, no boycotts. It's odd to invoke the market in such an anti-market sentiment. People boycott because boycotting works, and more importantly, because it's the only leverage available to us. People target advertisers because they're tired of their hard-won consumer dollars going to pay sexists and racists and homophobes who got those jobs, at least partially, by coasting on the privileges and benefit of the doubt conferred by sexism and racism and homophobia. Also, you know, you're not entitled to a job. It is okay for a white dude to be fired. It is also okay to draw hard and fast distinctions between different ideas. To say that some ideas are good and some ideas are bad. There's a difference between church groups boycotting JCPenney because JCPenney put a gay couple in their catalog, and gay people boycotting Chick-fil-A because Chick-fil-A donated millions of dollars to groups working to strip gay people of rights and protections. Gay people wearing shawl-collar, half-zip, A-Crew sweaters does not oppress Christians. Christians turning their gay children out onto the streets, keeping gay spouses from sitting at each other's deathbeds, and casting gay people as diseased predators so that it's easier to justify beating and murdering them does oppress gay people. That said, right-wing Christians should have the right to boycott and write letters to whomever they please. The goal is to change the culture to the point where those boycotts are unsuccessful. You do that by being